You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. You're at an undisclosed location.
That's right. And you're not going to get it out of me where I am.
You're at the non-zero realist headquarters.
You guessed. That's so weird. It's uncanny. That's where I am. Those are non-zero realist memos behind me on the wall.
Well, I don't have a cutesy opening because I'm going to start by admitting that you were right about something important last time.
I was actually wrong about something too, but I think you're moving us in the right direction. You're talking about something in the Parrot Room that happened in last week's Parrot Room.
Yeah, in the Parrot Room last time, we had a big argument over replacement theory, just apropos of nothing. Like the shooting hadn't happened yet.
Right.
We were just in the abstract talking about whether it was irresponsible of Tucker Carlson to invoke replacement theory. And you said it was irresponsible, maybe misquoting you, irresponsible of him to pick on the exact words that Nazis use and fringe crazy right-wing groups use. And I said, well, but you can't let these people... veto the terms of the debate.
The crazy people will have won if we avoid making the crazy people crazy.
And we couldn't talk about welfare reform if you worried about crazy people because crazy people are animated by welfare reform. And I can see now that you were right because a couple of reasons, but the main two reasons are the crazy people have guns and will use them in ways that... they hadn't used them since 2019, but they have used them with some regularity. So the cost of using their words is great, even though there's not much evidence that this guy in Buffalo was a listener of Tucker Carlson or was in any way influenced by Tucker Carlson or would have done anything differently if Tucker Carlson had never lived. You never know. In the background, his affirmations may have prompted some people on the Reddit and 4chan. He was a 4chan fascist, basically. And he listened to 4chan and maybe they were motivated in part because they knew that they had some approval from somebody at Fox. And the second thing is something I actually wrote about after the El Paso shooting, which was in 2019, mm-hmm. and which Jonathan Chait reiterated this week in a column I otherwise disagreed with, but this is, I think, a correct point, which is the slippery slope to violence when it comes to immigration, and this guy was animated by immigration, this shooter, is the slippery slope to violence is greater than on other issues. So even, very few people are going to go shoot up a mall over tax reform or the minimum wage or taxing the rich or excessive taxation, though some will. Or even welfare. Welfare does not prompt shootings the way immigration does. And there's a reason for that. It's because immigration takes a concrete form in if you're for immigration restriction or even this crazy guy believed that somehow that not only was there replacement, that the blacks who'd been here for centuries were somehow the replacers. Right. He was a full-on racist fascist. The people are there and you can, the object of your, if you're a crazy venomous person, the object of your venom is there. And what's more, you have some hope of succeeding. In other words, if this is why, in Germany, Nazis routinely beat up immigrants on street corners. It's because they have some hope of chasing these people out of the country in a way which you don't on minimum wage or tax reform. So the slippery slope is there and the violence is there. So you're irresponsible to adopt their terminology in a way that affirms them, even if it affirms also for other people who aren't Nazis. There's sort of an obligation to find better words, better rhetoric.
Right. I mean, not just, and I don't think it's just that replacement happens to be the term they use. So avoid using the exact terms they use. Replacement is a word chosen because it's part of a conspiracy theory that particularly incites people. They're trying to replace you. They're trying to replace you, which, as I've argued, is not strictly speaking true, even if you accept what Tucker is saying about how, yes, they want a lower, they'd rather have a better, they want lower wages, and they want, and actually one of his main spiels has been they're bringing them in to vote Democratic. Well, he, well that's certainly not replace, that's diluting your vote, it's not replacing your vote.
Well, it's replace, no.
This is how you started last week.
Okay. The, well,
saying replacement is accurate.
I don't think it's accurate. And in the conspiracy theory is the 200 proof version, as Ramesh Panure says, is completely wrong. And the attribution of 100% of the motivation of Democrats is electoral is wrong. There's idealism. Right. By choosing the electoral thing, I thought that Tucker was choosing what he thought was the least objectionable replacement theory, because people have been talking about how in the coalition of the ascendant, the immigrants were going to be in that coalition, and the working class whites, actually, you could say that they were being replaced in that coalition. And people have been talking about that. So all Tucker was saying is, take these people at their word.
Even if I accept that he chose the less incendiary of the two actual scenarios, the language he chose is intentionally incendiary, replacement. They're going to replace you. And his motivation is the same as the conspiracy theorist, in the sense that he wants to get people riled up. He wants ratings, and he's getting them. And what amazed me, which I didn't realize, is that in 2021, he said the following. First, he described this thing where they're bringing in these voters. They don't care about you. He compared it to, like, if your parents adopted new kids and started treating them a lot better than you, and they don't care about you anymore, and you'd be justified in saying they're trying to replace us. Well, again, not strictly speaking, but anyway, here's his quote. In political terms, this policy is called the Great Replacement. The replacement of legacy Americans with more obedient people from foreign countries. What I didn't realize is that he said this 2 years after the Christchurch mosque shooter titled his manifesto, The Great Replacement. And Tucker Carlson is using the phrase, The Great Replacement, after that happened. Okay? Right. I mean, it just blows my mind. And I just don't see the excuse. And again, I'm not suggesting that he not make any substantive argument he wants to make, including the ones he made. But if you can make them, actually, I would say more accurately, but certainly as accurately, without using language that, A, is the very language that is, you know, not even a dog whistle, it's so obvious, the very language used by the conspiracy theory racist crazies. And B, is language specifically designed to make people feel threatened in a way that I think is not exactly accurate. But because really, I mean, to be cynical about it, look, I've got, in a way, worse news for people who've lost their jobs to an immigrant or their votes are diluted. It isn't that anybody's out to get you. If anything, it's that they're not thinking about you at all. I mean, you know, coastal elites don't have meetings and scheme about how to cause you pain. They just want to make more money and stuff like that.
They love their coastal elite economy, and you are sort of
right.
Left
but
on
they
the
don't. But they don't sit there and think, "Oh man, you know that guy sitting in the, you know, in the diner in Ohio."
Well, Ann Coulter found one this week, boy. If you read her column, she found somebody who basically said, "You know, fuck you. I can't wait for you to die," and who's an actual expert on the deplorables and goes on TV. So I'll find that.
Monday, wait. Yeah, do find it.
I'll find that and quote it for you. I'm sure you'll be interested. But
in the parrot room.
Okay, but the point is, finding a new a better way to talk about it is is not that easy. I think this, after
are you
thinking
kidding?
About
to
it.
To avoid the phrase great hey, replacement, why don't you hear me do it?
Sure.
Oh, I just did it. He says they're intentionally bringing in voters who will vote Democratic and they will counterbalance your vote. So they're diluting your vote. That's accurate. They're intentionally bringing right. in people so, who will work
if you're looking for a
harder
phrase,
for less. Okay,
well, that's
accurate. This isn't hard.
That's a good one. The great dilution or cheap labor. But if you're trying to wrap all these up into one thing, I think either you could just throw back the coalition of the ascendant in their face. Like, that means you're not ascendant, right?
Look, there's 150 labels out there that aren't the phrase the great replacement.
Well, I don't think we need to find a good one, Bob.
Well,
being constructive here.
I'm happy to do one in my off hours for, you know, I mean, this is just not challenging.
Well, no, because you're trying to find out what the truth of this Tucker argument is in a way that doesn't fire up the Nazis. So another thing would be like something that the people are left in the dustbin of history or just the expendables. Or something that implies that they're still going to exist, but they're just ignored by everybody.
In a way, they're lucky. Hillary did the work for them. She actually called them deplorables. That works sometimes. But and that's used ironically, you know, or semi-ironically by the Steve Bannons of the world. But anyway, I mean, just
the discardables by everybody. Everybody uses. I don't think anybody uses. Nobody uses that not ironically anymore. Deplorables.
Hillary Clinton used it non-ironically.
Well, that was the last time.
Yeah, it didn't work.
But this will annoy you, but I mean, I do think, yes, they do stick around. Nobody's being replaced. But why, you know, they could argue, and I would never say this rhetorically in public, they could argue that they are like a non-fit trait in evolution, which, the people that have the non-fit trait, when the people with the fitter trait come along, they don't immediately disappear. But over the course of time, if the 60% of the fit people survive and 20% of the unfit people survive, eventually the entire population is fit people and there are no more unfit people over the course of centuries, decades, the fullness of time. I actually think they're sort of thinking like that because they do talk about natalism and birth rates, you know, and that's a long-term thing, declining birth rates.
Well, they're
eventually
not,
you disappear over centuries, you disappear, but you know, well, not anytime soon.
You don't
soon.
Disappear. Your offspring don't disappear. Nobody disappears. What happens is the percentage, and this is their concern, the percentage of white people in the American population declines. That
if
does happen. This has happened.
If you have a less than substitution birth rate, I think you eventually disappear, no? If your orange people are only producing 7 offspring for every 10 people, eventually they dwindle into nothingness and one is left and it gets run over by a truck and you're gone.
Nothing changes for thousands of generations. Yeah. And trends keep going until they don't go. And so this is at this point, we're just, you know, I mean, I don't know what to say. I'm just making
just
a very...
I just sort it out. It seems like, you know, they're not completely insane to think over the fullness of time, over centuries, generations,
but no,
they will disappear.
Look, if you don't have, you know, if white people don't have babies, there will eventually be no white people. That's true. If they keep having babies... There will always be white people, regardless of how many immigrants there are. Okay.
Right.
So I don't look. I just can we.
The
I
first
mean,
the first paragraph the first paragraph of this shooter's manifesto talks about white people need to have more babies.
Sure, so that's what the deal is. I mean,
I'm saying it's not insane. It's not insane within his own insane world to use the word replacement.
I think I've spent as much time being as clear as I can try to be about the fact that it's not literal replacement. It may be declining percentage of population, dilution, whatever. But the point isn't even, I mean, It's just that he's choosing to use the exact phrase that has already been used to mobilize a bunch
this
of crazy
Tucker.
Motherfuckers.
This is Tucker, not the
Tucker,
shooter.
Yes.
I agree
yes.
with that. I'm conceding that point.
Okay.
I was just making a little academic footnote aside about extinction in Darwinian terms.
Well, this would not lead to, what's happening now would not lead to extinction in Darwinian terms. It would lead to an ever declining percentage. Again, assuming nothing ever changes. But and leaving aside the question whether that, like, whether I should actually care what percentage of the world's population has certain genes for, you know, skin color that I have. I mean, that aside, it's not something I wake up about, in the middle of the night.
Chait says that the other crazy thing about replacement theory is, first, there's no conspiracy. We agree on that.
Right.
No conspiracy, at least elite conspiracy of the Jews. There may be a conspiracy of Chamber of Commerce businessmen to lower wages. And that's the purpose of the Chamber of Commerce, is to have a conspiracy to lower wages. But that's only a partial, that's not so elite, and it's only part of American society. The second thing is he argues that they imply that it's a zero-sum game. In other words, if the immigrants come, the natives lose, and it's not a zero-sum game, but it is not like we have just welcomed, the way it's put, but it's not like we have just welcomed some new people who are going to participate in this same wonderful non-zero-sum society that we have. It's phrased as the coalition of transformation. It is a transformation. And so it's not just there's something happening that may be threatening to people. It's not clear what Ron Brownstein means by transformation. I think he probably means, when he talks about the coalition of transformation versus the coalition of restoration, he's talking about probably something with like national healthcare and a European welfare state, which shouldn't be all that threatening. But some people may find it threatening, and it's not nothing. It's not, and it's not just non-zero utopia. There is a zero-sum aspect of it, which is once you transform the society, you can't have the untransformed society back.
What's the nature of the transformation you're worried about? I
don't know. He calls it the coalition of transformation, and I think this is right. He means the Democratic Party and its policies will change society, and there's always an element of exaggeration. I mean, one of the things about Biden is he thought he was a transformational president when he was really just nibbling at the edges of the welfare state, making little reforms here and there, even if he'd been wildly successful in his own terms. But the Democrats tend to think that, changing capitalist society 1% into a welfare state is transformational. I think that's what Brownstein meant, but he uses loaded words like transformation, which scare the shit out of people.
Well, almost every political rhetorician uses transformation in some way they consider positive at some point. You don't like the direction of transformation he's talking about. And
I sort of do like the direction of transformation he's talking about, but all I'm saying is that it's a loaded word, like replacement is a loaded word.
Transformation?
Yeah. He's not transforming. He's reforming the welfare state.
Well, they're never transforming when they say they're transforming. I'm just saying all politicians say this.
Well, sometimes they are transforming.
Gurus say, you can have personal transformation.
Sometimes they are transforming. So I think there's more to say about this in that
maybe we should save some of it for the Parrot Room. We're 20 minutes into this.
It is clearly the most important thing to talk about. Okay.
Well, there were the elections. There's Ukraine stuff.
Okay.
There's
okay.
That zany Jenny Thomas. There's Now, since you didn't have a visual aid this week, can I use one?
Yeah.
So, this page, front page of the New York Times, doubly exemplifies my nostalgia for a simpler and purer era in American journalism. There's two of the
Coalition of Restoration.
That's me. It'll be transformative. It'll replace all the came
it'll
before.
It'll be untransformative.
It'll replace the New York Times staffers. So just two headlines that trigger Bob. One is, and they're the same. And both of these, I maintain, are kinds of headlines you would not have seen. I think even 10 years ago, I think pre-Trump, honestly, even though only one of them is related to Trump. So in primaries, GOP voters reward a lie. Now that's, the lie, the big lie. I agree. It's not true.
What lie were they rewarding? There's so many of them.
Well, the election lie. I assume the election, Trump
the guy
won
in
the election.
The guy in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, for example. Okay.
Well, and he's the big example.
And
there are other people who lost.
And then, my issue is, strictly speaking, you don't know somebody's lying unless you know what's going on inside their head. They may just be wrong. And I honestly think there's a real chance Trump thinks he won the election. Others are more cynical and may know that he didn't, but they want to kiss up to him. Who knows? But it just used to be, I think, a matter of procedure at America's greatest newspapers. You don't use that word. You use, demonstrably untrue, maybe, or unfounded or whatever. You don't use the word lie because you never know. Now, then here's this other headline. Russia exploits capture of Ukrainians to push false terrorism claims. OK, so this is Russia. Finally, those guys surrendered in Mariupol. My hat's off to them for lasting that long. And of course, because they're the Azov Brigade, I mean, they're the guys that, they're a lot of what Putin means when he says Nazis. Of course, they're going to, we knew this, they were not going to meet an ordinary fate. Apparently, they weren't killed, which is good. But I think he plans to try some of them as terrorists. And the New York Times, again, I think in olden times, you would say they claim they're terrorists. Okay, now, I just want to say two things by way of background. Okay, so the Azov Brigade, as recently as 2.5 years ago, 39 members of America's Congress asked the State Department to deem the Azov Brigade a terrorist group. Okay, this is not, just sheerly a Putin hallucination. There have long been issues with the Azov Brigade. The State Department turned them down. I think it is safe to say, if you followed the history here, that at some point within the last 5 or 10 years, members of the Azov Brigade, at least some members of the Azov Brigade, have done things to ethnic Russians in Ukraine that, if they were done to Americans, we would probably call the people who did them terrorists. Other thing, what's that?
They use the same symbol as the Buffalo shooter used to start his manifesto.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. So there's this thing called the Black Sun. It's got 12. So the part of the Azov Brigade insignia that's normally singled out as having a Nazi legacy is the thing that looks a little swastika-ish, but it's kind of like lightning,
Yeah.
But in some of the Azov Brigade, and I don't know how old these patches are. They could be very old. There is behind that this dark sun, this 12 like sectored sun or something that is an exact replica of a Nazi thing. Right. Apparently. And anyway, the Buffalo Shooter.
Anyway, you were on a roll. I interrupted you.
Want to say, like, a few years ago, Trump declared the Iranian, the IRGC, which is a big component of the Iranian military, a terrorist group. And a lot of people said, whoa, this is unprecedented. Nobody's ever called a part of the military of a state government, a terrorist group. Well, Putin is now following in his footsteps. But the larger point I want to make is, I suspect if you kind of looked at the evidence and tried to argue, okay, IRGC isn't terrorist, Azov Brigade isn't terrorist, I suspect it would be kind of the same type of challenging question to get to the bottom of. In both cases, you'd have some evidence, but certainly with the IRGC, a huge percentage of members of the IRGC would not have done things like that. It's a very large group. Probably the same with the Azov Brigade. But the New York Times would never say America's false declaration of that this is a terrorist group, okay? And again, I know I'm naive. My ideal of a journalist is somebody who transcends national identity.
I would have thought you would have praised the New York Times because its editorial page is moving in what I would consider a better direction, which is they're saying, what exactly are, after being gung-ho, all, you know, endless war for Ukraine, they're saying, what exactly are our war aims now? Do we want to bring this war to a peaceful close, that to a close in a way that respects, you know, Ukraine's sovereignty? Or do we want to, like, weaken Putin and depose Putin? And there have been all sorts of noises about, you know, weakening Putin. And, you know, there was a David Frum tweet that alarmed me, which said, we have a huge opportunity now to strike it, you know, to win giant victories for the West. And that sort of talk scares me. And the New York Times is sort of pulling back from that. And that's a good thing. I think their editorial page is now out of sync with their front page.
Yeah, the editorial was very good. And it, you know, they basically said a lot of, I mean, I found myself in like 90% agreement with it. Like they said that they, you know, they think we need to tell Ukraine that we you know, it, first of all, it is an endless war, could be a very bad and dangerous thing. And we need to tell Ukraine, we're not going to support an endless war. And we need to get them to, in effect, to start thinking about solutions to this that end with something other than them taking back everything, including Crimea, which is just either not going to happen, but only happen in the context of some kind of apocalypse.
And we now have 40 billion arguments in our favor, having passed this massive aid bill.
Yeah.
And nobody really makes, maybe they do, but people don't really make your point, which is we should insist on some conditions to this 40 billion. It's not just a gift from the United States to Ukraine.
Right. You know, somebody, there was a Ben Wittes, you know, he's a prominent, blobster.
He's Lawfare.
He's Lawfare, which is Brookings. He's a very prominent, you know, he's the guy, if you remember, who during Russiagate, every time there was a development he thought was significant, he'd fire off the little cannon. You remember that?
Yeah, that didn't age well.
No, because it turned out there had been no significant developments in Russiagate, and yet the cannon had fired many times. Anyway, I want to go over a Twitter thread of his. I'll do this in the Parrot Room. It'll take a little while. In reaction to this New York Times editorial, it's just a classic of blob non-argument. It's like zero actual argumentation. What?
I'd be interested in that. You can go to it now if you want.
Oh,
okay.
If you want me to, I will. Where are we on time? Or we could leave it if we have time at the end. I could do it.
Okay, but there are other things to talk about. Okay.
Yeah. As long as we're talking Ukraine, I got to do my mea culpa. By the way, yours was done very gracefully and well.
I have one more point to make, but go ahead.
On Ukraine?
Yeah, which is the fact that he's making a big deal of winning Mariupol, or, you know, capturing this town and putting these people on trial. Isn't that a sort of a good thing in the way that it lets him claim some sort of victory, which might conceivably help achieve some sort of settlement?
No, I kind of felt that way. You want him to have a chance to crow to, I mean, especially if it's something that was inevitable anyway, which this was. It's not a surprise that eventually they'd surrender. You know, you'd like it to be the kind of thing that will make it easier for him to stop the fighting, you'd hope, in the not too near future. I feel I have a kind of related reaction to Sweden and Finland apparently being on their way to joining NATO. On the one hand, I wish Americans would take all these things more seriously. And when somebody wants to join NATO, they would pause and say, okay, this is serious at our end. We are saying if they are invaded, we will come to their aid. And of course, it is, for practical purposes, not reciprocal, because we're not going to be invaded by Mexico or Canada or something, right? Like, so at least think this through. That said, I think since it's going to be basically impossible to end this war with Russia completely expelled and Putin getting completely negative reinforcement for this, it's good for him to get what negative reinforcement he can get. And in a way, Finland joining NATO, Finland especially, is that. In other words, it'll be more reason for people to look at the invasion and go, well, this didn't go well for him. And So it has that upside, whatever you think of expanding NATO. And of course, traditionally, I'm not a fan of expanding NATO, to put it mildly.
You were making some other point about Ukraine. Well, I interrupted.
Yeah, well, so there's something I got wrong last week. And I think I got it wrong while you were away from the camera. Don't ever do that again, Mickey. You went to answer the door.
Yeah, some people objected to that. I don't.
Well, anyway. I object to it because it led. I had to fill the time, and I said something stupid. It was when you came back and said, "Are you still talking about the river?" The river was the problem. So here's what had happened.
Oh,
I was making the point that, in my view, the kind of Western sources for information on this war, especially including the Institute for the Study of War, this kind of neocon arms industry funded thing that the New York Times relies very heavily on.
Part of the Kagan industrial complex. Into the discourse.
I have reflected on that phrase a couple of times since you threw it out last week. I like that, the Kagan industrial complex.
Anyway, go ahead. But
of course, there's also the Crystal industrial complex and the Kagan crystal industry. It gets complicated. And I was saying, like, for example, and this was news that was just breaking at the time, and I was got a little over my skis. I said, you know, there were a satellite shot of a bunch of tanks, a bunch of armor blown up around a river. And the West was saying, wow, we totally, you know, destroyed the Russians here. But now there's some evidence that maybe some of the vehicles were Ukrainian. And also, it looks like the Russians, one way or the other, got across the river in any event. The river thing may be true. They may have gotten across the river at a different crossing. But if so, they were beaten back. And it's conceivable some of the vehicles were Ukrainian. But the fact is, this was an overwhelming defeat for Russia in this specific battle, at least according to the consensus that congealed. And I have not heard any of the pro-Russia people who were originally, and I think honestly raising questions about it. They weren't trying to mislead us, but I haven't heard them pushing back. So I think I was wrong about that. I will say, though, I shouldn't bring this up. I may just make the same mistake, but I think we're in the middle of something like what I thought had happened that time, which is just that it's, you know, I told you, I think I mentioned that, you know, weeks before Russia had taken this town of Popasna, I had heard from, you know, like the Russians with Attitude guys saying, keep your eye on Popasna, very important town. And then the Russians took it, and nobody in the West kind of acknowledged it. You know, these guys explained why it's important. It's elevated. I think it was pretty well defended by Ukraine. Russians took it a couple of weeks ago or something, or a week ago. And then yesterday, I haven't checked within the last few hours, but I think there's still good reason to believe something that was clear 24 hours ago, but is still not penetrated Western consciousness, apparently, which is that the Popasna has become the site of, there are like arrows branching out in all directions from Popasna by one, particularly the West. The Russians have apparently, some people make it sound like an actual breakthrough of the kind we discussed, where you just keep bombarding the lines and then finally, you know, it's no moss and they find a place to get through. But in any event, it seems pretty clear that partly because of what's happening in Popasna and Russian thrusts out of Popasna, and partly for other reasons, this city town it's called Severodonetsk in Luhansk. It looks like that's going to be the next big battle, but also, I don't know. We'll see. But I think even as we speak, it's becoming harder for them to say, well, the Russians are making almost no progress in the East. I fear we'll see.
Why do we want to say the Russians are making no progress? We want to say the Russians should declare victory and go home.
Yeah, I mean, that's. Yeah, I mean, the question is how little you would like the smallest amount of fighting that can happen that can lead to an enduring peace, you know, and that has to be something that Putin can at least claim as a victory. Now, the truth is, he's taken a lot of land. Look at the map. He's, you know, there's a lot of land They have restored the supply of water to Crimea, which is good for farmers and everything. You know, Ukraine had cut that off. They're holding the land above that allows them to do that.
Taking the land and holding it are two different things.
Well, they are. And I think in that area in particular, it may be challenging around, or at least around Kherson. But this Severodonetsk, if they take that and this town immediately adjacent to it, that'll pretty much be the entire province of Luhansk. That'll give Putin a chance to do some more bragging if he wants.
Do you buy any of the Putin health rumors?
It's funny. None of us look better as we get older. I don't know. I speak only for myself, Mickey. I'm not referring to you. But it may be a little unusual to look so much puffier. I don't know. Is it? Can that just be weight gain? That's the unusual thing, is, right? He looks puffy.
Right. I guess he looks puffy. I don't know. People look puffy when they inject steroids into their face, when they take steroids and when they inject Botox into their face. But why would Putin care that much about wrinkles?
I mean, well, there have long been thought that he's had cosmetic surgery going back a ways.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you're going to attract the youngest, finest gymnasts in Russia, you really need to pick up the lines around the eyes.
It's not just enough to wield despotic power. You also have.
What's the point of despotic power, Mickey, if you're not dating the youngest, finest gymnast in Russia?
Well, it's a
you
question.
You brought up Darwin. I didn't. But,
yeah. Okay. Well. Okay. I was troubled. I thought it was amazing that Mitch McConnell, who's now completely broken with Trump and backed the $40 billion and wholeheartedly, not like sort of tepidly, like a lot of people, like Rich Lowry, but wholeheartedly said, if we want to stop the Chinese in Taiwan, the way to do it is to win in Ukraine. So he's basically adopted the whole Niall Ferguson prediction of what the West, would do, which Niall Ferguson, I think, thought was idiotic. Has now been embraced explicitly by Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, I don't know. That's Taiwan's a complicated question. I think, I mean, I've warned against what I think may be a mistake we made in Ukraine, which was sending in a lot of weapons and stuff since, the Trump, I guess midway through the Trump years or something. Thinking, well, we're building up the deterrent, decreasing the chances they'll invade. I think in retrospect, it's fairly clear that Putin just saw that as a growing threat, realized it was going to get worse. That's not the only reason he invaded, but to the extent that it factored in, I think he was like, well, better act now. It's getting a lot worse. So you got to be careful because that incentive has two sides.
My impression is that the Ukrainians were not like insensitive to this. When we sent them the javelins that Obama wouldn't authorize and Trump would authorize, I think they kept them in storage because they figured if they deployed them, it would provoke Putin. So it's not like they may have miscalculated, but it's not like they didn't try to calculate.
Maybe. I think there was a genuine perception on the Russian side that Ukraine was preparing for a much more thoroughgoing assault on that separatist-held region.
That was midway through Trump's presidency, so it was a long time ago.
It was. But I mean, I think that was the context for the way he read everything since, all the weapons going in, and of course, now obviously, that's. I have to issue the disclaimer, none of this excuses an invasion. I mean, the land he was worried about was not his land. It was still within the sovereign territory of Ukraine, the part that was separatist held.
I should have said Trump's first presidency. I wonder how long it will take for the Trumpists to adopt that and start calling it the Biden interregnum.
Jenny Thomas is probably already doing that. Now, so did you see this news flash right before we taped? Kind of. I think it was like a plan.
No, is it? I think all the Jenny Thomas news flashes are not very important, but go ahead. She's a crazy weird.
That girl. But this is, you tell me if it's new. You follow this stuff more closely than I do. This is from the Washington Post. Virginia, quote, Jenny Thomas, conservative activist and wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, pressed Arizona lawmakers after the 2020 election to set aside Joe Biden's popular vote victory and choose, quote, a clean slate of electors, unquote, according to emails obtained by the Washington Post. That seems like not nothing to me.
I mean, guess it's a little beyond what had come out before about around January 6th, which is like, you know, her grasping at any straw that might legally produce a Trump victory. This sounds like one that would illegally produce a Trump victory.
Yeah, and she is the wife of a Supreme Court. And you gotta kind of assume, I mean, it wouldn't shock me if they more or less a shared worldview here, and that Clarence himself, if these Arizona lawmakers had called him, might have said, yeah, give it a go.
I don't know. That seems far-fetched, but
now
maybe he just likes her zany craziness.
She would inject real dynamism into any marriage, I think. Now you are, I await your interpretation of all these elections, of course, on this particular issue. It's what is it? Mazzatriano, or what's his name in Pennsylvania, who was scaring Democrats, especially because
I don't want to try to pronounce it, but in Pennsylvania, you know, everybody agrees there were mixed results. He lost some in Idaho. In Pennsylvania, he endorsed this crazy guy, I think it's Mastriano, for governor, who many people fear is a surefire loser in November. And he also endorsed Oz against McCormick, who was this hedge funder, who was, they were both vying for his endorsement. And it looks like Oz is going to, they're still counting votes. There's going to be an automatic recount probably, which means that anybody could win, but it looks like Oz is going to eke out a, like, you know, 10, 20, 300 vote margin by the time they officially finish counting. And then who knows who's going to win after it. I'm emotionally rooting for Oz just because for some of the same reasons Trump might have not endorsed McCormick is as my friend John Ellis said, McCormick was a comer. In other words, McCormick is running for president. He's not running for a senator. And the day after he gets elected senator, he's going to start campaigning for president, and he has a plausible shot. So if you don't like a Goldman Sachs type hedge funder being president, you want to, as they say, you want to shoot his missile down before, shortly after it leaves the launch pad, not wait till it's in descend mode. And so that's what Trump tried to do. He tried to strangle the baby in the bath, and may have succeeded if Oz, you know, if Oz wins. So that's a potential sort of mini victory for Trump. John Ellis argues that his losses, he endorsed some really crazy people in Idaho who got thumped, and Ellis argues that that's okay. It doesn't really damage him because he's trying to show, you know, the base that he's with them, and that sort of has value even if he loses. There's sort of a split between those who sort of want to say that Trump is losing and he's going to get killed next week in Georgia because the two people he hates are going to win big, Raffensperger and Kemp.
Raffensperger is especially resonant.
Right. I think he hates, yeah, but he hates both of them.
He was the Secretary of State who, though a Republican, kept insisting, look, this election is legit.
Right, but I think Kemp did too. And so anyway, he's going to...
Raffensperger was in charge of the process directly.
Okay, right. There are people like Peggy Noonan who look for signs that Trump is losing his grip on voters, and they quote this Kathy Barnett quote. She finished third. She was the dark horse, yeah, who I thought might take it all. We had your Trump values before you came along, and we were Trump. You know, Trump came to us. We didn't come to Trump. And that's sort of bogus because, I mean, Trump really did put together a coalition that was new, that hadn't existed before. The Tea Party existed, but they were very anti-government. Trump's coalition is not anti-government. It accepts big government. It accepts Social Security, accepts all sorts of things that Republicans had never accepted on that scale before, except that even that we shouldn't touch Social Security. So Trump should get credit for that, that Barnett doesn't get credit for. But I think there's a way, so everybody's looking for a way, how can we get Trump not to run again? Well, one way is if the base rejects him. And I think Ellis is sort of right that there are not enough signs that the base is rejecting him yet to say he, you know, he's going to get defeated in the primaries. Worth a shot. But the other possibility is we want him to have a Putin-like off-ramp. And this writer for the Washington Post, Paul Kane, suggested what might, to my mind, be an off-ramp, which is he's going to have all these senators, at least maybe four, who sort of owe loyalty to him and not to Mitch McConnell. So he could get rid of Mitch McConnell and fancy himself the power behind the throne in the Senate in a real way that Obama never did. Obama could have had that authority if Obama had run around the country endorsing people and building a network of people loyal to Obama. He could have been the Democratic dark power, you know,
so
even now.
Actually depose McConnell as a bone to Trump?
Yeah, that's and continue and install a Trump-approved guy, and Trump could say, I'm the kingmaker of the power behind the Senate. I don't have to run for president. I have all the power I need. It would be bullshit, but it would save the country from a second Trump
term.
Would
this be like an explicit deal? You go to Trump's place and say, look, we'll get rid of Mitch. You got to promise us you're not going
to
run.
Some of them have promised to get rid of Mitch.
Yeah, who would believe his? Nobody would believe a Trump promise. I mean, would you, if he agreed to do something, would you?
Well, if he agreed to endorse you, yeah.
Wait, maybe I'm confused. I thought this was going to get him to drop out of the race. No?
Oh, you mean an explicit deal to drop out of the race? No, yeah. I wasn't thinking that explicit. I was just thinking in his emotional id, if it looked like he might embarrass himself in the run by not, you know, winning by his big, you know, and he's looking for a way out. And also he gets, you know, a way to keep all that money that he's raised.
Mickey, have I told you about the lessons of Munich? You give him Mitch McConnell and he'll take Poland or something.
Well, as long as he doesn't run, he can try to run the next time. At some point, he's going to be told to run. Mm-hmm. He can say, yeah, I'll run in 2028. That's fine. Settle for that now.
How old is he?
I don't know. That's easily findable.
This is the thing. The Democrats, you just have to run somebody reasonably young, articulate, clear, and then Trump is just going to look like this doddering fool. But if you run him against Joe Biden, he's going to seem maybe not quite young and dynamic, but...
He doesn't look like a doddering fool in any respect. He looks...
Oh, come on. What did he do? Just
he's
what
still
was his
dynamic.
Famous, wait, what was his famous gaffe that if Biden had done it... oh, by the way, the George W. Bush gaffe. Could you believe it?
That was an excellent gaffe. Wasn't as bad. Wasn't as great as the Madison Cawthorn gaffe.
Which was what?
He tweeted about how he's not going to take orders from the Gentile elite.
What did he mean, gentle?
Well, he said he changed it to genteel.
Oh, genteel, yeah. That makes more
sense. Which is plausible that he didn't know how to spell. But
but it's totally plausible. It wouldn't make sense for him to mean Gentile, right? He's a Gentile. If anything, he would mean Jewish elite, right? He's a Trumpist.
You could twist it into an anti-Semitic thing where he'd written off the Jews and now the Gentiles were after him. I don't know. Anyway, it's the Bush gaffe was, but then he said Iraq too. That was the incredible thing.
I thought that was what he was saying, kind of under his breath. I mean, he was trying to just turn it into whatever kind of joke he could turn it into. I think most people who saw that didn't appreciate how perfect it is. Iraq was what we... Often the way we often couch rightly, I think this is when we're couching the indictment of Russia the right way, is that the big crime was to indict a sovereign nation, a violation of international law. That's exactly what we did in Iraq. And I don't know how many Americans really appreciate that that we did exactly the same thing. Now, the difference is we didn't, well, we weren't, we didn't, you know, so obviously planning to occupy the territory, but we were planning to keep bases forever there. That's what the Weekly Standard was editorializing for. They were, and, you know, well, but anyway, same crime, folks, same crime.
I don't quite buy the Bob international borders or everything argument. Didn't Clinton claim that there was, they had authorization under previous UN decrees that Saddam was violating? So there was some, well, some international law argument that Bill Clinton, well, at the time when he wanted to endorse the war, said, you don't even need this UN resolution. We have all the authority we need under the previous resolutions.
I think that's probably bullshit. I mean, there is a common misconception that, like, if a country violates international law, then it, or violates some UN mandate or something, then if you, an individual nation, take it upon yourself to decide they violated it and punish them, you have international law fully on your side. No, it's like if I think my neighbors are dealing drugs and I break into their house and there's drugs, I still face, you know, I was supposed to call the police. I don't have that authority.
It all depends on what the terms of the UN resolution were. Maybe the terms of we will end this Iraq war, you know, the first Gulf War, and the grounds is that we deputize the coalition of the willing to decide when you, Saddam, have violated it. We don't know what the terms were. I don't know anyway.
Yeah, I haven't heard a very strong argument. I mean, Kofi Annan himself, the Secretary General of the United Nations, said it was illegal.
And I'm maybe a bigger supporter of the Iraq war than Bush. It still seems to me that's a significant, not majority, possibility that in the long run, it will work out for the better. But clearly, the government of Iraq now is better than the government that was there before. They have elections. The guy's trying to please people.
Brutal. Yeah. I mean, too bad about all the people who have died.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of dead people. I agree with that.
People die.
But I'm just saying.
Quickly back to the election. This Fetterman guy in Pennsylvania. Is he going to win the general?
Most people think no.
When I see him posing with that "Don't Tread on Weed" flag, you know, and I don't know, man.
He's traditionally progressive, but he's made concessions at various points, like he switched his position on fracking, for example. So he will. He's a very formidable candidate because he has all the attitude of an ordinary guy, and he has left positions, but he will change them when necessary to please the electorate. And this guy McCormick, if McCormick wins, he's tailor-made for Fetterman to run against. Running against a rich hedge funder from out of state, you know. I mean, that's perfect for him. Oz is a little more difficult, and most people seem to think that the Republican will win just because it's a Republican year. The Democrats are building up Fetterman as their savior. They would run him for president in 2024 if they could, maybe, you know, they could have him and Stacey Abrams, two losers who have national potential but couldn't win their states. But he seems to be an appealing guy. His wife was very appealing. He has a great wife.
Wait, Fetterman's wife?
Yeah, because Fetterman had a stroke and his wife is talking for him now.
Yeah.
And he's had a pacemaker implanted. So for a few days at least, he's not doing much talking.
I'd be careful about oohing and aahing over his wife, man. That guy could crush either of us with his, like, between his pinky and his thumb.
I have more agility, Bob. One of the things I wanted to talk about, they're like, seven bogus Biden like themes of, oh my God, I'm in trouble. I better stress this and this will save me. And one of them is, you know, I can be more like Fetterman. Another one is this poll tested thing.
Wait,
where
you mean this is what Democrats are thinking, or Biden himself? Biden can't be like Fetterman.
the Democrats are thinking, but they probably are thinking that even Biden can be more like Fetterman, more approachable, talk to voters, you know, you know, it's all a matter of attitude. They're like, Biden has this poll tested theme where he's discovered that MAGA is unpopular. So he's, you know, he's calling the Republicans MAGA, ultra MAGA, super MAGA, on the grounds that there's a slight differential that voters don't like the word MAGA. Roe is going to save him. Calling the Republicans crazy election deniers is going to save him. Talking about white supremacy is going to save him. Dumping on this Rick Scott agenda that, if you read it right, would sunset Social Security, which is like a completely bogus charge. Obviously, the Republicans aren't going to sunset Social Security. That'll save him. The one thing that he's not trying is doing what Fetterman did on fracking, which is moderating his position. So even if he would want to moderate it, it's not clear he could get away with it. There's this very telling page in this Will Not Pass book where Biden goes out on the stump and he says, as he had said in the campaign, I don't like student loan forgiveness beyond $10,000. I was like, give him $10,000. That's my limit. Okay. Within a day, President Klain had overruled him and assured Democratic progressive groups that, don't worry, Biden doesn't mean what he said, and got Biden to switch his position. So who's in charge here? Even when Biden wants to move slightly to the right, his staff doesn't let him.
Yeah.
So anyway.
That sounded like it should be an issue of your newsletter. You got the seven things that they think can save him.
And I've
got something better that's totally unlike the seven. That's classic. You should do it.
But once I've said it here, what's the point of going to the labor of writing it?
No, see, this is the kind of thinking that keeps you and me mired in obscurity, Mickey. You look at the great names out there in the modern media ecosystems, and they're all saying the same shit.
Well, that's the Dick Stroud principle, which is write every piece three times. And maybe Glenn Greenwald does it, but other people like Matt Iglesias generate so much copy, he doesn't have to repeat his pieces three times. He doesn't publicize his pieces enough. He has another one waiting. He doesn't have time to publicize the previous one.
But we think there's actually more than one Matt Iglesias too, don't we?
Well, there's less of him now than there was before because he's lost some weight, apparently.
Okay.
You could stretch him out and he'd be Fetterman. But anyway, never mind.
I just meant to stand in awe of his productivity. I'll leave all the other commentary to you. So we've been doing this an hour, Mickey.
I'm trying to think if I had any more top line above the fold topics.
I feel I should hedge on what I said about this town of Popasna because I'm probably out over my skis again. But it does seem like the thrust to the West is an example of the other thing we were talking about where, you know, you just keep, look, first of all, I think both the Russians and the Ukrainians are taking more casualties than is obvious in the East. I just think it's a bloodbath. But, you know, we had been talking about how if you just, the Russian approach of just endless artillery bombardment, it's like, doesn't look like they're making progress, doesn't look like they're making progress. And then one day you reach this critical mass of destruction and carnage and the line breaks. And it looks like maybe that happened west of Popasna. Maybe not. And of course, when that does happen, the troops that exploit it can always get overextended. That happens a lot. And then you've got them in a so-called salient.
Right.
As we say. Yeah.
No, the other things to talk about are not, they're paradable.
Okay, so let's talk about what some of them are. Have you seen any of Severance yet?
It took me forever to get to get it to work, to get Apple to work, I had to remember my fucking Apple password, which is like, I live in dread of having to remember my Apple password.
Have you thought about writing it down?
There's too many passwords to write down. I think my Apple password may be Apple password. But anyway, I figured it out.
Wait, you don't write down your passwords anywhere?
No. I'd have to hunt for the piece of paper to write them down on, and that would be all another layer of complexity.
Okay, one thing we're going to do is I'm going to counsel you on password management, okay?
Okay.
And this is free for anybody else who wants to listen, although you do have to pay.
I've seen the first 10 minutes of Severance, and it seems promising.
Okay, well, we can raise at least one Severance-related issue then, if you know what the premise is.
Vaguely. There are a couple of things to say about COVID. There's the baby formula. There's the huge developments in Elon Musk Gawker sex scandal.
Wait, you know, there's an Elon Musk sex scandal?
Yeah, it's a bogus scandal. It's like he settled for $250,000 with a stewardess who accused him of harassing her.
Wait, all he did was harass her, and he had to give her $250,000. I would think
$250,000.
I should have a word with him. What?
I would think that would be the nuisance settlement fee for a guy like Elon Musk, but maybe I'm wrong. But maybe a little more. I think she may have been an employee, and he said he offered her more money, buy her a house if she gave him a little more service than was maybe normal, and on a private air flight.
We're in the parent room territory here. We don't talk like this on the public podcast, okay. Mickey.
There's Amber Heard.
There's other
versus
Elon Musk stuff. And COVID, there is COVID stuff I have too.
There's the Amber Heard trial, and there's a debate whether this trial is at all important or not.
Amber Heard, Johnny Depp. I got sucked into a little YouTube's algorithm has got me totally figured out, and they sucked me into that.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Plus a commenter in the parrot room. Thanks a lot, Molly.
And they didn't suck you into Elon Musk? Okay, that says a lot.
I'm conversant in Elon Musk things, except I'm not interested in sex generally. So I didn't.
There's a Jonathan Chait article that I actually liked a lot.
It's his news. You buried your lead. No, Mickey Kouse likes John Chait piece.
It's about charter schools, Bob.
Go ahead.
Anyway, there's Title 42, unemployment fraud. That's what I got.
Okay. I'm going to talk a little more about the latest chapter of Dead End, the podcast about the murder, the politically charged murder in my neck of the woods.
Is that why you're in an underground bunker?
I tell you, if I keep talking about
because
this.
You're like on the lam.
You joke, but Bob every once in a while has second thoughts about what he says in the parrot room about this subject. It's New Jersey, Jake.
They'll find you, Bob. If you're at the bottom of the ocean in a submarine.
That's after they find me that I'm at the bottom of the ocean. I'm going to finally say this thing about the origins of Ukrainian nationalism. That'll pack the house. That'll get them in. I guess I'll do this. I will do an exegesis on this Ben Wittes thread. It's just a classic of. It's like he's a big guy at a think tank, and it's just another reason they should just rename the think tanks field tanks. This isn't thinking; it's feeling. We need think tanks. Okay.
He has thought before.
He has thought.
I liked him because occasionally he writes something that's against his shtick.
No, he's a smart guy. And the funny thing is a certain amount of stuff on Lawfare is hyper cerebral, but I'm sorry. This is just beyond the pale.
If we're getting into the complicated story, I have my, discussion of the complicated issue about using inflammatory concept like replacement theory that Ramesh Panuru ducked in his column. And I think it's an actual difficult issue. So we'll get to that.
Okay.
Pinpointing it. I have a chart. See a chart.
Oh, good.
I had a Matrix. I even had a Matrix. Anyway,
That'll get him to go to patreon.com/parrotroom and join the many happy patrons, one of whom got me sucked into the Johnny Depp Amber Heard quagmire.
Suck Bob in.
Suck Bob in.
I can have said it better. See you there.